Welcome. You are listening to the UC Davis Center for Poverty Research Seminar Series. I'm the Center's Deputy Director, Mary Ann Page. This series brings scholars and poverty experts from around the country to discuss their work on United States poverty and poverty research. In February 2014, we hosted Herman van der Werfhorst, Professor of Sociology at the University of Amsterdam, where he also serves as Director of the Amsterdam Center for Inequality Studies. Van der Werfhorst studies the sociology of education, social stratification and mobility, and labor market sociology. Here he is presenting his seminar, Early Selection in Educational Systems and Two Forms of Inequality.
The general story that I want to talk about is about issues about educational systems, how they look in a country, and how that differs between countries. That's the main story that I'm, the main issue that I'm interested in at the moment. I'm from Europe, and in Europe, every single country has its own educational system. You might say that's the same here in the US, with all the states having their own policies at the state level. But the differences are much greater than the differences between the states in the US as far as I see it. Although I know that some states have a German-type educational system, we have very different systems in Europe. One of them is the German-type system with very early selection in different tracks, or I should better say school types. Compared to Scandinavian systems where kids go to school together until the age of 16, which could be called a comprehensive school system. So that dimension of educational systems, the extent to which kids are tracked in different school types, is really the central interest of today's talk. The reason why this is, I think, relevant to study is not only academic, in the sense that we get to know more about how inequality is produced between generations, but also from a policy perspective, I think it's quite crucial to know how educational systems play out in terms of the distributions of skills or other kinds of inequality. So my research agenda is really about looking at educational systems, look at several characteristics of those systems. One of them is tracking, another one is the vocational orientation of systems and how that relates to the labor market, for example. I'm also interested in civic outcomes. And today I will talk about inequality by social background in educational achievement in particular, skill achievement, and also inequality in civic outcomes. I think that's a very understudied phenomenon, civic outcomes, certainly when it comes to institutional characteristics of educational systems. I don't think there's any study on that yet. So hopefully I can contribute a little bit to that literature by emphasizing that we have to look at educational systems not just by focusing on one sort of inequality, but try to understand how it relates to different sorts of outcomes in order to understand how well an educational system is functioning. So I talk about functions of education sometimes, and reducing inequality or offering equal opportunities is one function of educational systems, just like it is to produce citizens create some civic awareness among school kids so that they can become actively engaged citizens in their societies that they will live in. So that's the broad picture. And just to illustrate what I'm talking about, these are whenever I go to the US and talk about tracking, I tend to think that the American system is not so very tracked. And people say, well, you can't be sure, you can't be true, you can't mean that because you know we have a track system too. And I know the literature. Don't worry. But it's also important to realize what it looks like if you live in a different country, how tracking is happening. And this is these are two schools that are in my suburban town out just outside Amsterdam. And at the age of 12 or after grade 6, kids decide whether they, or not that they decide, but they get the opportunity to go into one school or the other. And one school is the pre-vocational school. This one. And this is the academic general school that prepares for higher education. And this is a really rigid selection, right? These kids go to these separate schools at age 12. They might never see each other again, unless there's some private involvement. They might go to sports clubs, but there's no state, government-oriented policy that would bring these kids together. And that separation is, I think, very rigid. And you might say it might be necessary when we want to teach mathematics or languages, but even that is contested, I can tell you, and I will show you. But it might also lead to what's also implicated by the system is that they also have separate sports classes and separate civic studies classes, things that you wouldn't think of just for the tracking you wouldn't invent just for that reason. But it's just a byproduct of the very rigid form of selection that prohibits kids to meet each other completely. It's a very physical separation. These schools are, I think, a kilometer or maybe 2 kilometers apart, maybe a mile. But they have very different different friendship structures and very different opportunities for later educational careers. So the selection is really rigid, far more rigid than you have in the US, is my impression. And that's, in that sense, this is the kind of the tracking that I'm talking about. It's tracking between schools rather than tracking within schools. That means that in that comparative picture that I tried to draw, I can't really say that I've captured all tracking, because I haven't captured the American tracking, which is certainly there, right? I'm not denying that or downplaying it at all. But it's a limitation, so to say, if you want to compare countries, because you could say that every country that has some form of tracking or another, right? Even in Scandinavian countries, kids are at some point separated within the class, like ability grouping within classes. So there's one form of selection always happening, I would say. But this is, I think, a more rigid form of selection. So if you think about tracking, I think there are several questions that we need to ask. First of all, we need to know whether tracking is related to inequality of educational opportunity. And there's quite a big literature on that, given that we have now very nice data sets, including the PISA data that you might know, and the TIMSS data. These are student assessments of mid-teenagers, 15-year-olds or grade 8 students. Those data are collected in many countries. The PISA is, I think they're now at 60 countries. The last PISA was in 2012. It's collected every 3 years among those 15-year-old age group. The TIMSS is a bit smaller, but is also collected in many countries. And it's also collected in grade 4 and in grade 8, so different stages of the educational career. There's PIRLS, the reading assessment, literacy assessment of younger kids. So there's lots of data available to compare countries and to relate inequalities of different kinds. So we know quite a bit on inequality of educational opportunity, although there are some serious omissions in the literature as far as I see it. Then another question is, of course, whether tracking is efficient. It might be efficient in the sense that it maximizes the skill production. Kids do just better. The performance is better if you separate them, because they can be taught at the level they need. And if you separate the bright kids from the less bright kids, you might get a more efficient or more effective teaching or learning process. That's at least one argument that some people make. And then another, as I mentioned, outcome that I want to study is civic engagement of kids, of youngsters. The labor market is another interest of mine, but I won't talk about that today. I'll first start with some descriptive pictures on relationships, on sorts of inequality that need further understanding, further clarification. And to do that, I, together with a colleague of mine, I created an index for tracking across countries that varies between across countries, between the countries. This is based on 3 indicators that are available by the OECD, the Organization for Economic Cooperation and Development. And that's the age of selection in the system, the 8 to 12-year-old selection as we have it in the Netherlands, age 10 at Germany, it's even more rigidly selected. The number of tracks that are available to a typical 15-year-old student, and the proportion of compulsory education that is tracked. Of course, these 3 indicators are strongly correlated, so we made an index out of them, which gives us much nicer plots than if we would take one of those indicators. So this is an index of tracking, and just to illustrate, here are the United States and Canada that don't have a track system. Again, I'm not saying that there's no tracking happening, but there's no between-school tracking. And of course, I should say, and I'm aware of that, I don't talk about segregation, which is also a form of inequality that, well, according to some people, is just producing the same kind of inequality as tracking. And if you look at the countries that track very rigidly, Germany is on top here, and the Netherlands is here, NLD. So that's my country. So you see quite some variation. This is the average, is 0, and the standard deviation is a bit less than 1 on this indicator. And then we have a nice distribution. So that's just that's this variable here, the tracking index. Here I've just, as a descriptive plot, regressed mathematics performance on a social background indicator. I'm using here the number of books in the household, because that's known to be the best predictor in those data sets. And it's also available in grade 4 in the TIMSS, so it makes it that I need to use it. But you could replace this with occupational status of the parents or parents' education. You get more or less the same graph. which is that this is a regression slope. Y-axis. So you see that with more tracking, you see that the regression slope of mathematics regressed on the number of books in a household is positive. And that's both the case in TIMSS, in grade 8 students, and in PISA 2009. So you see that there's a positive slope, but there's also quite some scatter around that slope. So we can't say that that indicator is perfectly predicting the inequality level in the country. But at least there's a positive association. And I think the literature thus far has basically shown that this is there. And they control for all kinds of variables. And I can show you some evidence of my own research that shows that cross-sectionally, at least, there's definitely a positive association between tracking and inequality of opportunity in terms of mathematics achievement. Right, so that's the positive slope that I'm interested in as a descriptive or an explanandum, as we would call it, something that needs explanation. Just to illustrate another form of inequality, this is the difference in civic engagement for two groups of people. People that graduated from academic tracks in high school and those that graduated from vocational tracks in high school. These are just European countries that have some form of differentiation in higher education, including the Scandinavian countries where they do have vocational education after age 16. And this is also an inequality measure. And this is, again, the tracking index. And this concerns electoral participation, being interested in politics as a civic outcome, trust in institutions, so whether people have trust in the parliament and in the government and in the police and politicians and the legal system, an index for that. And you basically see, again, see this as some sort of a descriptive plot, that with more tracking, inequality tends to increase in terms of civic engagement between groups of people. So my concern with civic engagement is that there's no theory of justice you could imagine that would legitimate this form of inequality. Unlike inequality in mathematics performance, unlike inequality in labor market outcomes, where you could have a theory that, or a moral theory, that would justify those kinds of inequality, I think it's much harder to think of such a theory when it comes to civic outcomes. So when equality is let's say, harmed or affected negatively in terms of civic outcomes, there's definitely a moral issue at stake that cannot easily be defended by claims that inequality is good for society or it creates incentives or these kinds of things. I can't think of a way that we want to create incentives for some people to go to vote at elections and discourage other kids to go to vote at elections. So
we've done that before, I think.
Sure. I mean, yes. But I'm not saying that everybody subscribes that moral theory. Okay, so what I will do is highlight three omissions in the literature. One of them is that it's very cross-sectional this far. It's just looking at these cross-sectional associations, regression models with control variables and those kinds of things, where we have multi-level models with contextual variables, country-level indicators of tracking related to inequalities of opportunity, for example. And there's no study that shows that there's no inequality enlarged or larger in societies with more tracking. But it's very cross-sectional. It's also very theory poor. It's very macro. Tracking is bad. Tracking harms inequality. But we don't really know why and how inequalities are produced in those societies. So we need to dig more into the, let's say, the micro-level theories of how educational decisions are made and how the institutions that people are part of, the world that people are part of, the country that they live in, how those institutions affect those decision-making processes at the level of families or teachers or these kinds of things. Third, the main focus has been on, as I mentioned, on inequality in labor market outcomes, but not so much on civic engagement. By the way, I'm trying to combine issues of a paper here, another paper with a graduate student, and a book project that I'm working on. So this is all trying to fit together, hopefully, and if not, then not. Maybe just to explain, I try to base my work in the institutional literature, and I think one definition of institutions is, for me, the most useful is the one by Sam Bowles, who argued that that institutions can be described as formal and informal rules and regulations that give a durable structure to interactions among members of a population. This is a very, very good definition for me because it highlights both the formal and informal rules. And to get to the theory, the micro-level theory that we need to address, we need also to include norms about education in families, these kinds of things. So we need to produce, to create a theory that is about formal and informal institutions. In my theory that I'm developing, there are three premises. First, if we look at inequalities that exist within a country, we can assume that, or the theory assumes that people act more or less rationally given the information they have, the options they face, and the choices they want to make. So I'm trying to not to hinge too much on theories that have a very passive character of individuals, where people are socialized in a particular fashion and the only thing they can do is just make the choices they make. I try to have a more active understanding of human beings in my theory building, and this relates clearly to the more rational choice approaches in educational decision making, as they have been developed by Richard Breen from Yale University, Steve Morgan here in the US from Cornell, and John Goldthorpe from Oxford. So that's the basic premise. Then the institutional context in which people live can switch on and neutralize those processes that are happening at families when people make decisions about the options they face and the goals they have in life. So in that sense, the institutions are important because they can, depending on the system, kids have or do not have an option to choose for different tracks, right? So if there's no option, even if families would want to give advantage to their children, it's much harder than it is in societies where kids are offered a very early choice to choose for one type of education or the other. And the younger kids are, the more dependent they tend to be on parents, as the life course hypothesis of the old stratification school would have it. And if people are younger when they make decisions, if parents are more important, then of course it might the choices that are made are less dependent on their own achievements, but more on the parents' preferences. So that's the kind of theory that I'm developing. Then last, I think it's very important to also understand that institutions don't really fall out of the blue, right? They come from somewhere. They are initiated, and I can't really study the initiation of those institutions. I have to go back to the 19th century in the Netherlands if you want to understand the Dutch system of education. And I do that theory-wise, but not so much empirical, I guess. But there is some empirical research that you need to do, I think, if you want to study this, which is how norms of important stakeholders in educational decision-making, whether it's parents or teachers or even the students themselves, whether those important stakeholders develop norms that are related to the institutional structure. So this could involve teacher expectations, teacher interpretation of student effort, parental involvement in schools that could be harmed by a certain system if their children happen to be in the wrong track. These kinds of norms that evolve may legitimize and perpetuate institutions as they are. So if you ask, in that one debate we have in the Netherlands all the time is about this 13-year-old guy, let's call him Pete, who can't learn, who should work with his hands, so we should have an educational option for that person. So we shouldn't keep him into an academic learning environment, but rather we should provide vocational skills early in life at age 13, 12, because this guy can't learn. That's my feeling is that sentiment is not something you hear in Scandinavia, where kids are separated much later, not at least for the 13-year-old kid. It's only an option, it's only a discussion issue, it's only something that people can start to think about if the institutions allow them to think about these issues in that way. So if people justify these existing structures by the opinions they have, then of course this might legitimate the institutions. And even though every now and then we have discussions in the Netherlands about early selection, overall, I don't think many people would really think this is a bad thing. So I try to, and it's not very easy, but I try to get a grip of that as well. So what I show you is, I don't show you this. This is just a replication of what is known, cross-sectional research on these inequalities that are stronger in more recently tracking systems. I don't think I have the time for that. But I will focus more on three difference designs that are trying to get away a bit from the cross-sectional field. Although, I mean, I'm not claiming that we have a very strong causal test here about tracking causing mathematics inequality. Although I think the theory of early tracking being harmful to equality is much better tested with these kinds of models than with cross-sectional models. So that's what I'm doing. what I'm doing is I look at two difference in difference designs on mathematics achievement. One compares student assessments of 1964, the first international mathematics study, which is the predecessor of the TIMSS, which used to be, the T would be the third international mathematics and science study, but now the T has been replaced by the TREND, so they can keep up the TIMSS name. So the TIMSS is now the TREND in the international mathematics and science study. So I'm using the FIMS as the first one, and the SIMS, which is the second international mathematics study of 1981, I should say. And the good thing is that between those 2 years of observation, this was the era when a lot of debate was happening about equality of opportunity, much more than now today, I think, at least in the Netherlands, when many educational systems have been reformed, and many, I think in all of the educational systems that I'm studying in this particular design, there has been quite a bit of debate about equality of opportunity and promoting detours around the system so people can switch tracks. And so it's been an issue in all those societies. But the good thing is that there were 5 countries that were tracked in 1964, but they have reformed their educational system into a comprehensive system between 64 and 1981. So for those 3 countries, I'm comparing how inequality is changing by social class background relative to 2 countries that have not changed the system. So they have retained the track system. So that's the difference in difference design here. I will explain it later what it looks like. Then a second design is quite similar technically. It's identical technically, I should say. And here I compare grade 4 and grade 8 students that move in some countries from an untracked primary school into a tracked system. And in other countries, they move from an untracked primary school into an untracked environment still, a comprehensive system. They remain in the comprehensive system, so to say, between grade 4 and grade 8. So that's not about reforms, it's just about changes across the life course, so to say, across the early life course. And there I do a very similar design, but just looking at how the slope in inequality by social background changes more or less depending on whether the change is positive or negative. Whether they change more in terms of inequality in those systems where kids move into a track system, then the movement would be of the regression slope. The change would be in the regression slope if kids move within a comprehensive system. They stay within the comprehensive system. So that's the second difference in difference design. And then there's a third difference in difference design that looks at civic outcomes, and that's completely different. It doesn't look at social background so much, but it really looks at civic outcomes as such. And it looks at some sort of a treatment, which is the number of tracked years that people will encounter between the first moment of observation, which is when they're 14, and the second moment of observation, which is when they are 20, early 20s. None of these difference in difference designs are based on data where students are followed. So I don't have matched data on the individual level. I only have data collected in different points in time for different subgroups. So also for this, I compare 14-year-olds to 20-year-olds, but they are of the same cohort. So I compare the 20-year-olds 6 years after I observed the 14-year-olds, so to say, just to illustrate what it will look like. But I'll get to that. This I will skip. This is just to illustrate the cross-sectional results. This is the number of books in a household times tracking index. It's positive, so more. Larger inequalities, this is positive main effect of social background on mathematics achievement. This is a positive interaction term, so this number of books effect is increased, is stronger in more tracked systems, and that's the case independent of the controls that we put in terms of educational systems, or in terms of income inequality and its interaction with education, or with the number of books, or GDP per capita, or educational expenditure. So that's just a multivariate cross-sectional analysis that we've seen in a number of studies. So now let's go to the difference in difference designs. So this is the first international mathematics study, grade 8. These kids are all in secondary school, or grade 8 at least. Then there's a second international mathematics study of 1981-1982. And I've standardized mathematics achievement within the wave. This is necessary because the tests are quite different, and so what I'm comparing is really the relative position within the distribution of the countries together. We can can talk about that later. I think this is the best way to standardize it given the data. Then I'm looking at parents' education, and that's measured quite differently between the waves, but also between the countries within the waves. So with data from 1964, the world is far from ideal. So what I do is I make a proportional score of education, of educational background within the country in that survey, in that wave. It's just a score between 0 and 1. 0 would be the theoretically lowest category possible when everybody is higher educated than you, and 1 would be the theoretically highest possible value if everybody would be less educated than your parents, I should say. Then there's a dummy variable. I'm not using this tracking indicator because that's measured in the early 2000s, so I have to have this reform index, right? So that's a comprehensive versus a tracked system within the country wave. So that's constant for the non-tracked systems, for the systems that have retained the tracked system. And it's variable if a reform has been implemented. So these are the five countries: Belgium, England and Wales, Finland, France and Netherlands. All of them were tracked in 1964. Two of them have retained the tracked system, the Netherlands and Belgium, despite the big discussions that were there too about inequality of opportunity. It's not that this is not happening as a public issue, but they haven't done anything on the system. Whereas three countries, England and Wales, Finland and France, have really reformed their educational system. And this reform from Finland is said to be one important reason why Finland is doing so greatly. So just to show you the model, this is the regression model. This is a mathematics score of individual I in time t in cohort C. Time is wave, 64 or 1981. There's an intercept, there's fixed effects fixed effects for time, the dummy, which wave it is, fixed effects for countries. There's an indicator whether there's a comprehensive system or not, or tracked, which varies between waves within countries if it is a reformed country. So you can identify that model with the fixed effects. There's a slope of a parent's education, and there's the interaction term of parent's education times this comprehensive education dummy. If you look at the parent's education effect in T0, sort of wave one, so to say, 1964, the education effect, the parent education effect, is this gamma. For T1, it's also gamma in those societies that have retained the track system. If you have a reformed system, then the education effect, the parental education effect, is gamma. But in T1, the education effect, the parent's education effect, is represented by gamma plus is lambda. So the difference estimate of the parent's education effect is lambda, is this one, the interaction effect. I run this model on the mean with regression techniques, but also on the 20th percentile and the 80th percentile of the distribution, conditional on the model, so with quantile regressions. Well, this is just a distribution. Here are the results. This is the reform analysis. So here's the main effect of comprehensive education, and here you see it's negative. It's important to realize this. Then here's the main effect of parents' education. It's positive, not surprisingly. So kids that move up from the lowest theoretical possible value to the highest go up one standard deviation across the mathematics distribution, or 0.8 standard deviations across the mathematics distribution. This is the mean, this is the 20th percentile, this is the 80th percentile. This is negative, it's important to remember. And then this is the interaction term between parents' education and comprehensive educational system. So this is the difference estimate. And it's negative, meaning that this positive slope of parents' education is tilted negatively, is becoming less positive, less strong in systems that have reformed their educational system. Then this is negative, meaning that if you think of this in terms of efficiency, with the reform, the average position within the distribution in that wave across those five countries has decreased. So this could lead to the conclusion that there's an efficiency loss in terms of a reform to comprehensive education, which fits with the equality versus efficiency trade-off that has been studied before but has been refuted before all the time. So other studies that looked at cross-sectional data basically found no effect of the comprehensive, of the no main effect of the institutional variable, leading to conclude that there's no efficiency gain from tracking or such. But here we see there's a loss. But I think this is a shock effect because of the reform. I have some evidence for that here. I'm not sure if that's very strong evidence, but at least if you look at the reforms that took place in different years, England and Wales is around 1970s, a bit mixed. It's not a continuous, it's a bit of a few years, actually. Finland, it was 75, and France, it was 1980, just before the second wave of data. And we see that the effect size of the reform, if we include only that country as the comprehensive reform country, gets more negative the more recent the reform was. So that might suggest that this might be a shock effect, but we don't know that. It could also be just efficiency loss. These are the predicted plots for those results. Oh, by the way, I should say that so these lines don't have the same slope, and they have by definition the same slope resulting from the model. So we see that this is 1964, the solid line, and you see that with reform, these are the countries that have reformed their system on the right-hand side. We see that the slope is tilted a bit downwards, it's less strong. It's certainly not away, right? We don't have full equality of mathematics learning, not at all, but it's definitely less strong. And that pattern is stronger if we look at the lowest percentile, the lowest part of the distribution. But we don't find it in the upper part of the distribution. So we do find that inequality is decreasing, especially in the bottom with reforms. So this is the second difference of difference design. Here I've got a lot more countries. I think it's 21. And some of them, it's only a few, by the way. In some of them, you move from grade 4 to grade 8 into a tracked system. So in Hungary, in grade 4, you're together. In grade 8, you're separate. And that happens in grade 7. In Lithuania, you move into a tracked system, and that's in grade 6. And there's another one here, Singapore, you move into a tracked system, and that's in grade 7. So, but most countries, you see that kids are still together in a comprehensive system at grade 8. So for the identification of the model, it's a bit sad that we have so few countries, but again, I mean, there's all kinds of differences between these countries that have nothing to do with the track system, right? It's about development, maybe, and Singapore is a very special country, I guess, in many ways. So, again, I'm not making very strong causal claims in the way that economists would talk about causality, but I do think that we gain a lot by looking at this across the life course between grade 4 and grade 8. So in grade 4, we assume this is all comprehensive, and in grade 8, it's in some countries tracked, and in some countries it's comprehensive. Now I have to use the number of books in the household. I can't use parents' education anymore, because in grade 4 in PISA, this is the only question that is the only data that is available for kids in TIMSS, grade 4. It's the only data that is available of the parents. So this I code in the same way as a proportional score within the country wave. Math is again standardized within waves across the countries, and it's the same identification method. Show you this. Here we have the model, difference in difference model, number of books in a household, the positive slope. Quite similar, you see, in terms of the size of the effect to the previous model. Comprehensive education, in this case, is positive. So here there's no trade-off between equality and efficiency, at least in this design. And this is what, according to some economists who have identified the same model comparing municipalities in Sweden, this would be seen as the causal effect of comprehensive education, of a reform. Well, we just look at the causality across the life course. So, but anyway, we see that if countries stay in that comprehensive system, there's more gain of mathematics. And here we see the interaction term again. This is the causal effect, or the, if you want to call it that way, of comprehensive education. And you see that that's again negative. So in systems that have comprehensive, where kids stay in the comprehensive mode, so to say, the slope is weaker, is lower than in countries where they move into a tracked system. Obviously, the next step in my analysis will be, and I can't show you this, is to look at other changes that could happen or other variables that could be related to this to these outcomes. Thinking of economic development could be quite an important issue. Although, if you want to look at the difference in difference, of course, we should observe differences across time in that economic development, and I'm not so sure if that's really a big issue for me, but that's definitely something that I need to test. Same picture, this is the tracked system and the comprehensive system. These are by definition equal slopes, and here we see that this is grade 4, and you see that this in tracked systems the slope goes up relative to the to grade four in grade eight, and that's especially the case again for the 20th percentile more than, but also for the average. Okay, I don't have time for this, but I've done some sensitivity analysis. The thing is, I can't do like the what they call sometimes the placebo design by looking at something that happened before, because there's no data set before 1964, unfortunately. But I could do it, but only for three or four countries, by looking at 1980 and 1995, because there's a TIMSS. But that gives me only three countries, of which two have been reformed or something. So it's not very large data set, but I could do it. But here I looked at the years since comprehensive reform have taken place, because that changes, that's different across these three countries. For the first design, and for the second design, I looked at the grade level at which this, so how many grade levels they have been tracked, so to say, when they are observed in grade eight. And I mean, it's just the same pattern. I can do two things. I can show you something of the mechanisms of the teachers and the parents, or I could show you something on the civic outcomes, or both, but that's going to take a bit more time. I go briefly through the teachers, because I think it's important. This is all macro and it's interesting, but we need to dig more into the processes, and there are some interesting results. What I think is happening is some form of defeatism among actors. I'm not sure if this is good English, where important people for children's learning, including themselves, feel defeated, feel that they can't take part in the rat race of achievement. And so teacher defeatism would affect some kids, especially if they're in the lower tracks, in the track system. And parents might also lose interest in their parents' in their children's education if they're in the wrong track relative to their social class. So what I did, I'll show you the graphs because then that's easier. This is all from multi-level models. This is cross-sectional. Only looking at the TIMSS data, grade 8 teachers. Teachers could be teaching the bottom 25% of the class average. So it's the bottom 25% of the class average, that's the way to look at this, or the top of the 25% of the class average. And here is the most important finding. This is a statement whether uninterested students harm teaching, asked to the teacher. And this is controlled for the class composition socially, for the mathematics achievement of the children, even the mathematics attitudes of the children, all on the class level. So what we see is that there's a positive slope here with more tracking. You see that, especially if teachers are teaching the bottom part of the distribution, they get more critical of their students being harmful, independent of the average achievement in the class, because that's controlled for. Teacher expectations go down with tracking, but that I would expect this to be going down for the lower part, but it's also going down for the higher part of the distribution, which is a bit surprising. These are the kids that are selected positively and can flourish, so that's I have to make sense of that, but at least this is in line with the hypothesis. Then I look at parents. Do high SES parents get less involved with their children's school if their children are low performers, especially in track societies? That could be called some form of parental defeatism. And here's what I find. This is the parents of top performers, the top 25%. This is the parents of low performers. And this is the high SES line, high SES line. This is the low SES line. And here we see quite clearly that in more tracked societies, especially high SES children, high SES parents become less involved with their children's school. So this is about teaching to talking to the teachers, being part of some committee on the school. There's an index that PISA has created. So with PISA I can do the parents, and with TIMSS I can do the teachers. I can't do them both in one analysis, unfortunately. So apparently there's something happening relating to the track system, especially when it comes to low performers. Okay. 5 minutes for my civic outcomes part of the story. Here I do difference in difference. It's important to realize I'm not talking about parents anymore. Forget about parents. But I do look at 14-year-olds because there's some sort of PISA, but then about civic outcomes. This is called the CVET. It used to be called the CVET, civic education database. Again, in many countries, it's collected among grade 8ers, again. So quite similar to the TIMSS, it's organized by the same organization as TIMSS. So I'm looking at the grade 8 students in 1998-1999, and I compare them to the same cohort of the same countries in the ISSP data, which is the International Social Survey Program, an adult survey, which have been asked the same questions, exactly the same questions of civic engagement. Roughly the same cohort, although for ISSP 2004 I have to take a broader age group than just the 19-year-olds, which would be the matching age group, because I need data, right? I need a number of, I need N. So I did this with a student, I should say, Jacqueline Witsche, a graduate student. So we have a 10-year age range of this second observation window, so to say. And this is civic engagement before and after tracking, we call it. 14-year-olds, some kids are tracked already. We've tried to solve that too, that issue, but this is before tracking and after tracking. And the treatment is the length of tracking between that observation at grade 8 and the end of secondary school. So in most cases, this is around age 18 or 19, and there's a number of years in that phase. And of that number of years, you could be tracked the full amount of years or just a shorter amount of years. So that's our indicator of tracking. And then we, as a second analysis, but I won't show you that, we've also counted the number of years that they have been tracked before the age of 14 as part of our tracking treatment indicator. And we have a similar design with fixed effects for countries and time, and the track years variable, which is set to zero for the first observation year. But then, of course, it could be 5 in Germany or something like that. Okay, this is all clear. This is just a civic engagement index. Again, these are asked both in ISSP and in the CVET data. How interested are you in politics? How often do you discuss politics with peers? How important is it for a good citizen to vote in every election and to obey the law? And I made a standardized index of those. So we made a standardized index of those indicators. Here is the model. This is the tracking index, the treatment variable with country fixed effects and time fixed effects, which is negative. So you see that this is the lower part of the civic outcome indicator, the 15th percentile. This is the 85th percentile. So we see negative slopes, especially for the bottom of the distribution. So you see this is stronger, although I think it is significantly different from this slope. So we see that with more tracking, if tracking lasts longer, the more years kids are tracked, the lower the average of civic engagement, especially at the bottom. But it's also important to realize that once we control for participation in higher education, at the level, this is all at the level of this country, this is no longer the case. So early tracking might lead to lower participation rates in civic engagement rate, because it leads to lower participation rates in higher education. At least that's the explanation that we try to build upon. Because higher education is quite crucial to become politically engaged and these kinds of things. Okay, these are graphs for that. Conclusions. So I think we've shown larger inequalities in tracked educational systems compared to comprehensive systems, both across time and across the life course, and across in terms of civic outcomes. And some results point to a trade-off between efficiency and equality, although not all results, it's a bit mixed. The trade-off has been refuted most of the times in data sets, also a difference in difference designs, but we found at least in one case some evidence for it, and we thought this might have to do with the shock effect of a reform where achievement just goes down for a while and then catches up later, because the longer the reform has been the less negative this main effect was. And I think there's a central role of important agents, parents, teachers, students, in how institutions are legitimated and how they can remain to exist. So that's my presentation. Thank you.
I'm Anne Stevens, the director of the Center for Poverty Research at UC Davis, and I want to thank you for listening. The center is one of three federally designated poverty research centers in the United States. Our mission is to facilitate nonpartisan academic research on domestic poverty, to disseminate this research, and to train the next generation of poverty scholars. Core funding comes from the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services. For more information about the center, visit us online at poverty.ucdavis.edu.